So there's a lot of little of different names for what more or less amounts to the same thing. Thank you for inviting me here. This is my first time to Perimeter. I've had a great time so far. Certainly enjoyed the view and the conversations we had at lunch and the various people I've met here. So, and of course, I've never, I think, given a seminar in front of people with such comfortable seating arrangements before. So that's also a plus. So this is work that started a while back in the late 2000s. And just by way of background, so I started life as a physicist. I got my degree, my PhD in theoretical physics from UC Berkeley in the late 90s. And then I moved into the chemistry realm for various reasons that I won't get into. And so it's obviously a very different culture, a different kind of environment. But at a certain point in the 2000s, there were a bunch of us in theoretical chemistry who found that Bohmian mechanics was actually a practical tool for something. It turned out to be a very promising and useful practical tool for solving real quantum dynamics problems, solving the Schrödinger equation in the context of nuclear collisions. So when I'm talking about nuclear collisions, I'm talking about chemistry. So we treat the nuclei as little point objects that collide, and maybe you start out with one set of molecules, you wind up with another set of molecules. So for us, high energy is 10 electron volts. You know, it's not, we don't change the identity of the nuclei or anything like this. So anyway, I'd heard about Bohmian mechanics, you know, as a physics graduate student at Berkeley and various other places, and it was interesting to me that it would actually be a practical tool for chemistry, and so I got involved in this. And there was this community of people who were working on this, and I won't talk about computational aspects today for the most part. Given the audience, I'll focus more on the mathematical formulation itself and also a bit on interpretation if people are interested in that. But so we worked in this area, and then progress was made. And at a certain point around 2009, it occurred to me that it was a really redundant thing to propagate both trajectories. And let me be clear, we actually have a family of trajectories that we have to propagate, quantum trajectories, and a wave function. And that's the way that things were done at the time. We were propagating both. And of course, Bohmian mechanics, as we'll get into a little bit later, says that you need the wave, but then you only need one trajectory on top of the wave, and that's what reality is and so forth. We were propagating many trajectories because we were using sort of Bohmian ideas to do our calculations, and a wave, and that just seemed incredibly redundant. And so I asked the question, is it possible to get rid of the wave function and do the calculation just with the family of trajectories and without the wave? And it turns out that the answer is yes. And in the beginning, of course, it started out just being simple things, one-dimensional models. But then over time, we've thrown more stuff into that, multidimensional applications, many particles, relativity. We're working on spin now. Spin's kind of tricky, it turns out. But it seems that it's possible to do all of quantum mechanics without wave functions. And not only without wave functions, but without complex amplitudes of any kind. So this isn't path integrals either. I get asked a lot, you know, aren't you just doing path integrals? That has no wave function either. And no, it's not, because there's no, there's nothing that's complex valued. So over the years, there have been a number of people who have worked on this. I just mentioned the ones that I'm aware of. So before we got involved, is there a pointer in this, the middle button here on the top, maybe? Yes, okay, it's a little bit dim, but. So these two guys here, Peter Holland at Oxford, and this Algerian fellow, Ahmed Bouda, they had both done some precursor work to this, I would say. Nothing in their work suggested a new interpretation. Also, the mathematics was very limited. In Bouda's case, for example, he was looking at one-dimensional time-independent problems. But anyway, there were some precursors out there, although we found out about it only later. These are people that I personally have worked with, this middle bunch here. Especially relevant for this talk is Jeremy Schiff, a mathematician at Bar-Ilan University in Israel, who was interested in some of the non-relativistic aspects of this, particularly reparametrizing the coordinates, as I'll talk about in a little bit. And then also other people have gotten interested in this. These Europeans here, Christoph Meyer and Jan Michael Ross from my field, from chemistry. Then these physicists here got interested in this in a big way back in about 2013, 2014 or so, Howard Wiseman, Dirk Deckert, Michael Hall, and they developed what's essentially a discrete version of the theory that I'll present today. So in both of these theories, there are ensembles of trajectories. In our approach, that ensemble is a continuous one, but here it's a discrete one. So the continuous one is what you need to be completely consistent with mathematics of quantum mechanics, the Schrödinger equation, and so forth. But you know, you can posit that there might be some very small unit of space, Planck length or whatever, and that we haven't done measurements down to that scale yet. But when we do, then we'll notice some differences from conventional quantum mechanics. So that's the basis of this approach here. And it has some advantages and disadvantages with what we're doing. And then also, Lee Smolin here has gotten interested in certain aspects of this. I just learned actually about this maximum variety paper from him the other day. So I haven't had a chance to read that yet, but I look forward to doing that on the plane ride back tomorrow. And Chip Siebens also is somebody else with a philosophical bent who's looked at this stuff as well. So the first paper we published on this was in 2010 in an unlikely place, Chemical Physics. Unlikely given that even in this journal we discussed the notion that that there might be a new interpretation of quantum mechanics here, although that wasn't really our main focus. So we noted that it would be possible if one wanted to put a kind of a many worlds interpretation on this mathematical structure. It would be sort of a natural thing to that would be suggested by the mathematical structure that came out of this, although it would be a very, very different kind of interpretation from the Everett many worlds. And if people are interested in understanding the differences later on, we can get into that.
Maybe I just throw in I have a paper, among others, that has almost your title, Quantum Mechanics Without the Wave Function.
Okay.
But I have a sense it may not be exactly along these lines. But
is it real? Is everything real valued? Or
if you like, it can be
okay.
Real valued. But
okay, well, I certainly would want to learn about it.
Only the real part enters in the end. But
okay. All right, well, I would certainly like to learn more. So. So, and again, with this kind of work, it was born from this sort of practical place, and so it's a very different community of people than sort of where it's wound up, and it's sometimes kind of hard to keep track of what's happening everywhere. So anyway, this first paper was, as I said, it came out of this idea of Bohmian mechanics, although it's not really Bohmian mechanics, as we'll see, although it's similar in some respects. And then some more papers came out eventually after this. So this is the first paper that Howard Wiseman and his collaborators wrote, and I was asked to write a commentary on that for Physical Review X. And so that's when sort of my world started to intersect with the physics world, and specifically people interested in foundations of quantum mechanics and that sort of thing. So all right, here's a brief outline for the rest of the talk. I will, based on comments that I get during the talk and expressions on people's faces and so forth, adjust what I present. I certainly have way more slides than I can hope to get through in an hour. But there are a lot of different aspects of this that could be discussed, even if one throws away all of the numerical stuff. So first of all, what is this approach? As I said, there's no wave function. There are no complex amplitudes. So what do we have instead? We have ensemble of trajectories. So if we have just one spatial coordinate x, ordinarily, one would have a time-dependent wave function, psi as a function of x and t, which is the thing that you would solve the Schrödinger equation for. Well, this gets replaced with an ensemble of trajectories, x, as a function of t, and also a trajectory label, a parameter coordinate c. So we go from this thing. I'm having trouble seeing this, so I think I'm going to use the hockey stick over here, if that's permissible.
It's encouraged.
It's encouraged. All right, great. Yeah, that's right. Okay, so so we go from psi of xt as the fundamental entity to x as a function of c and t, and this is the thing that we're solving for. And if you just were to get rid of c, that would just be a single trajectory. But c then it becomes a coordinate that labels individual trajectories within our ensemble, and it becomes essentially an independent coordinate along with t. So this is very, very important. From a mathematical point of view, the role of x is elevated from independent variable to dependent variable. And right off the bat, if we want to compare, for example, with classical mechanics, if we want to consider the correspondence principle, how do we turn quantum mechanics into classical mechanics? That's very tough if you're working with waves. It's also very tough if x is, on the one hand, an independent variable, and on the other hand, a dependent variable. It makes it a lot easier in this context to do that kind of thing. So both from a practical and a more fundamental kind of a perspective. So this is the thing that we're trying to solve for. And we get a family of trajectories out. And the individual trajectories that we get turn out to be the same quantum trajectories that you get in Bohmian mechanics. However, this is not Bohmian mechanics for several reasons. First of all, in Bohmian mechanics, one has the wave, and then one has one trajectory on top of that, and it's sort of a hybrid ontology. In this approach, and this again comes directly from the computational origin, we have an ensemble of trajectories. And of course, we don't have a wave function. Once you have an ensemble of trajectories, there's no need to retain the wave anymore. So here are sort of three different ways of doing quantum mechanics. We have Copenhagen on the left, just a wave. We'll ignore measurement issues for the moment. Bohmian mechanics, we have a wave plus one trajectory. The trajectory evolves according to this modified Newton equation here, where there is, in addition to the usual classical force, there's a quantum force, which is the gradient of the quantum potential. The quantum potential comes from the wave. So in this context, from the trajectory's point of view, the quantum potential is an external field, and it's not a particularly elegant external field. You can see that in general, it depends on not only x, but also on t. So it's space and time dependent. So you don't have sort of nice symmetry laws with respect to time and space translations that you'd like to see in a physical theory that indeed you do see in classical mechanics. So you lose something, I think it's safe to say, in this approach. And then you also have to bring this thing in from the outside rather than have this force be something that comes from the trajectory itself. In our approach, there's no wave. There's a family of trajectories. And we need some kind of a PDE to propagate this ensemble of trajectories. X is a function of C and T. And so this is what that PDE actually is. So again, it looks very much like Newton's laws, except for the addition of this complicated thing here. This complicated thing here has spatial derivatives, but these are now derivatives with respect to the C coordinate. So they're derivatives across trajectories. So this is, in some sense, inter-trajectory communication or inter-world communication, if you are into that particular interpretation. What to me is interesting about this, well, there are a number of things. One is the fact that this is numerically equivalent to this, even though it comes from a very different place. It comes directly from the trajectory ensemble itself. And it looks nothing like what Q looks like in Bohmian mechanics, and yet numerically it has the same value. That's why the trajectories wind up being the same trajectories as in Bohmian mechanics. It's also interesting because it's second order. This equation is second order in time and fourth order in space. So that's a little nasty. We're doing fourth order spatial derivatives, where again, by spatial derivative, I mean a derivative with respect to C. But that sort of mirrors the idea that the Schrödinger equation is second order in space and first order in time. But of course, the Schrödinger equation describes a complex valued quantity, whereas everything here is real valued. Again, there are no complex numbers that enter anywhere here. Everything is real valued. But there's another kind of subtly important aspect to that, which is going to turn out to be important for the relativistic generalization. I'm not sure I'll have a lot of time to discuss that. Again, depending on people's interest, I could spend more or less time on that. But we all know that when Dirac wrote down his famous equation, he was bothered by how you treat space and time on an equal footing, because the Schrödinger equation has different orders for x and for t. And so he came up with this multi-component scheme where everything was first order as his solution to that problem. But in this approach, we take a very different tack to solve that problem that comes from the fact that x, and later we'll see t in the relativistic case, are our dependent variables, not our independent variables. And so we have this extra freedom. In a sense, we have two space coordinates, c and x, and one is dependent, one is independent. And that gives us an extra freedom that we don't have in the wave-based approach that allows us to come up with something that's completely Lorentz invariant, even though it treats, in some sense, space as something that gets four derivatives and time as something that gets two derivatives. It's a different kind of space and time than x and t. So there are various other aspects already you can see in this equation that are kind of important for the relativistic in the relativistic context and more generally.
So C, if you relabel the names of the coordinates just with us, any invertible function, smooth invertible function, then do you get the same physics?
You do, and we'll talk about that.
So this equation is invariant under?
This equation is not. Okay. So I'm cheating a little bit. There is one natural choice of C for which the probability density is uniform. And that's the choice I use to give you this equation.
Here you don't have any probability density.
That's right, because it's actually there. It's there, but it's implicit. It's because the density is one everywhere. So there is a more general form of this equation that is the fully covariant form, where it does appear. So
a related question.
Yeah.
If you go to a higher dimension, spatial dimension, then C is going to live in same dimension.
That's right. C has the same dimension as.
Then this question of relabeling, reparameterization, invariance
will
be more complicated.
It will be, but it can be sorted out. And we have, it does become more complicated. And we do have the full form, the fully general form in many dimensions for arbitrary reparameterization, and then all of the various special cases. But this is the simplest case.
So are you going to put a sort of reference metric or reference volume element on this space of C's?
Yes, you can do that. I have probably today I have one or two places where I have that form up, and it's in our papers. But usually I work with this version just because it's easier. It's a simpler form, and it comes up in a lot of different places. But yeah, so this I didn't say that here, but this particular form of the PDE is correct or applicable to any choice of the parameter C where the probability density is uniform. Yeah.
First question. I mean, one way of formulating Bohm mechanics just writes down the guidance equation, first order in time.
Right.
Phase the wave function.
Right.
Can you specify your proposal in that language as a first order in time guidance type equation?
No, because you to do that, that's for the trajectory. Mm-hmm. And to do that, you've already solved the Schrödinger equation. Right. So if you want to write down this where you take the gradient of the phase, that's what you're talking about, right? So in order for that to work, you have to know what the phase is at all points in space and time. In order to do that, you have to have solved the Schrödinger equation already.
That doesn't seem like an adequate response, because I could have said the same thing about that equation. To know how x moves, I would have to solve the Schrödinger equation.
No, absolutely.
Could I reformulate that same equation without having solved the Schrödinger equation? Like, is there a different version of the guidance equation which says instead of referring to the phase of the wave function, it refers to the velocities, for example, of all the other trajectories?
So this equation here doesn't refer, you don't have to solve the Schrödinger equation first. This one here.
The one on the left.
Oh, the one on the left, yes, right. Uh-huh.
Right, so if somebody said to you, you've replaced something where you would have to solve the Schrödinger equation on the left, but something where you wouldn't.
Right.
And my question is really, could it be that there's an analogous form of both these equations, which are more of the guidance equation type? So we know that I could replace that middle equation with x dot equal to negative grad s.
Right, right.
And so it's conceivable that there might be another equation which doesn't refer to s, the phase of the wave function, but instead refers to some properties of all the other trajectories. But it's not an equation for x double dot, it's an equation for just the first order derivative.
Yes, that's probably true. If I understand what you're saying, in effect, you still have to solve something else first. So you're talking about solving this maybe in two stages, some first equation where you have some expression for x dot, and then a second one where you take the second derivative, something like that, or
maybe I'm not sure.
Okay. Okay. But just to be clear, when you're asking the question with regard to this equation, are you saying that do we still have a wave or no?
No. Okay. Just sort of asking, because we have these two forms for writing down Bohmian mechanics, first and second order.
Right.
My question
right.
was just, do we also have two forms for writing down your?
Yeah. So the short answer is no. Okay. Not that I'm aware of.
So my second question is, in Bohmian mechanics, the wave function really plays two roles. One is, you know, if, as it is here, the quantum potential tells the particle I've moved, but it also sets what the probability distribution over initial positions has to be in order to get the predictions of quantum theory. I started with some different probability distribution that was not the psi-squared distribution, and we get predictions that would differ from quantum theory. So is it fair to say that you presume the same probability distribution over the initial configurations? That your proposal was about the form of the time evolution, but not a proposal for how to understand the measure over the initial position?
It's not a proposal to understand the measure. You have to presume there is one. But once you know what it is at initial time, probability is conserved.
Right.
And so from that point on, everything is determined. But at the initial instant of time, that's right.
You want psi squared to get the quantum predictions.
Right.
So in that
right.
sense, the wave function has a role to play in specifying that distribution still.
Well, it doesn't necessarily have to be a wave function. You need some initial probability distribution.
Well, you need the probability distribution psi squared to get the quantum predictions.
I wouldn't call it psi squared. I would call it rho zero.
Right.
So it's the initial density. That's right. So as an initial condition, in addition to knowing the positions of all the, you know, x as zero as a function of c and also x dot as a function of c, right? Because it's second order in time, you need both of those, just like you do in Newtonian mechanics. You also need to know the initial probability distribution. And the probability distribution does play a dynamical role, right? Because this quantum potential is the same as the other quantum potential. And that, you know, the Bohmian quantum potential comes from the probability density. So it does play a dynamical role ultimately, but it only needs to be specified at the initial time. It's not something you need to propagate. The only thing you need to propagate are the trajectories themselves.
I think what Rob is asking is, isn't there enough information in this equation to know somehow secretly it knows what psi squared is?
Yes, you can extract.
You can extract, and once you do that, then you can say what the probability distribution is.
That's right, yeah. So, remember, this is a special case where I've defined C in a very special way. If I know that I've defined C in this very special way, then all I need is the initial x's and the initial x dots, and I can extract everything. I can extract the initial wave function at any later point in time, up to an arbitrary phase factor. Mm-hmm. So, and the reason why that's the case is because the other approach to Bohmian mechanics that he was talking about, the gradient of phi gives you the initial velocity field. So that's fine, but because you're taking the gradient, there's an ambiguity in terms of the overall constant that you add to it. So, and that just manifests as an overall phase factor, which has no significance in quantum mechanics anyway. So we don't worry about it. So, but yes, you can take, if you know that you're working with this special form of C, you can extract the wave function from this equation and from the initial condition, from the solution X alone. So this is really everything you need to solve the problem. Okay, so let me take you through. So there's various ways to derive this equation. I'm going to take you through a very simple derivation of the one-dimensional time-independent special case. And I like this derivation because it doesn't start from the Schrödinger equation. So we don't just, a lot of formulations of quantum mechanics, you start with the Schrödinger equation, you do some kind of manipulation, and you get something new that's mathematically equivalent. This turns out to be mathematically equivalent to the Schrödinger equation, but it comes from a very different place. It tries to come from more fundamental or principles. So I'll go through this quickly in the interest of time. So imagine that we have some kind of trajectory-based theory. And for the moment, we're considering just individual trajectories, not ensembles. So we have an x of t. And x of t is actually really a path. It's nothing dynamical yet. It's just some candidate way of getting from one point in space-time to another. And now we're going to imagine that we have two functional forms that depend on the path. One of them we call F. It's going to wind up being essentially the potential energy, but we don't know that yet. And another one we call G. That's going to depend on X dot, the first derivative of our path X, and that's going to wind up being essentially the kinetic energy, but we don't know that yet either. And this is basically all that we know at the moment. So we have arbitrary paths, and we have these functionals that we can compute along the path. So now what we're going to do is try to apply physical principles to constrain the sets of possible paths to turn them into true trajectories. And the first way that we're going to do that is by considering action extremization. So we're going to define, we need to define an action. And so we define, so the action is the time integral of the Lagrangian. We define the Lagrangian as G minus F in analogy with what's done in classical physics. But again, we don't know yet that G is kinetic energy and that F is potential energy. These can be any functional forms. Because this is first order in time, we know that that the path that extremizes the action, what we'll hereby call the trajectory, satisfies the usual Euler-Lagrange equation. And so now, for a given choice of functional G and F, we have a well-defined set of trajectory solutions. Of course, I haven't told you what F and G are. For all we know, G could be C times X dot to the 4 instead of some constant times X dot squared, the usual kinetic energy. But once you make a choice for F and G, then the trajectories are decided. Another way we could imagine choosing a trajectory, at least in this very limited context of 1D and not a trajectory ensemble, but an individual trajectory, is to consider what I call the Hamiltonian. What I mean by the Hamiltonian here is simply the sum of G and F. Again, reasoning by analogy with what happens in classical mechanics, where the total energy is the sum of kinetic plus potential. And in this very limited context, that's enough information, again, to specify what the trajectories are for a given F and G. But F and G are, again, unspecified. But now we want to put the two conditions together. And in general, these two conditions give you different sets of trajectories for the same choice of F and G. So, but there is one thing we can do. If we insist that both of them are true at the same time, then that will limit the set of functional forms for F and G that we're allowed to consider. So that's what we're going to do. And in effect, what this boils down to is, if you go back to the Lagrangian approach, we know that we have time translation symmetry. So Noether's theorem tells us that there's some kind of a conserved Noether energy quantity, and we're essentially just setting that equal to what we call the Hamiltonian, T plus V. So it turns out that satisfying both of these conditions greatly limits the allowed forms for F and G. F actually is completely unconstrained, it can be anything, but G has to be a quadratic form in X dot. So in effect, what we've done here is derive classical mechanics, Newton's laws, starting from two very basic physical principles, energy conservation and action extremization. Now, of course, we all know that Newton's laws satisfy those properties. But what we've essentially done here is the converse, gone in the other direction. At least in this very limited context, again, of 1D and so forth, we can show that those principles alone could be used to derive Newton's equations. So, all right, that's fine, but that's classical mechanics. It's not quantum mechanics.
Can I make a comment?
Yes, please.
I think Noether's theorem will apply no matter what form you put for the Lagrangian, as long as you have time translation.
That's right.
It seems to me what you've assumed is that the Hamiltonian should be the sum of the kinetic and
exactly.
Sort of forced you to have a second order kinetic energy, I mean, degree two kinetic energy.
That's right. That's right. Yeah.
So sort of, didn't you just build in the result that you want by that assumption?
We did get the result with that assumption, exactly. So, but beyond that, we don't force a form of F and G. That comes out the way that it comes out. But you're right, the original forms, they were inspired, if you will, by classical mechanics. But it's somewhat of a generalization away from classical mechanics in the sense that we can consider more general functional forms for f and g. But the fact that the Lagrangian is g minus f and the energy is g plus f, that's what we put in, and that's where it comes from. That's correct. Okay. So, but again, this is classical mechanics, it's not quantum mechanics. Well, we want to somehow get quantum mechanics out of this kind of an approach. And so the only place to go really is towards higher order derivatives. So we have to consider generalizing L and H to depend on x double dot and perhaps higher order derivatives as well, in addition to x and x dot. And again, we're going to make a somewhat ad hoc assumption about the form of L and H. And here we're going to borrow from Bohmian mechanics. So in Bohmian mechanics, we have this quantum potential. And we're going to treat the quantum potential as a potential in the sense that it's something that subtracts from the Lagrangian but adds to the Hamiltonian. Okay. But then actually, quantum potential comes from the kinetic energy operator, right, in Bohmian mechanics. And so that's going to sort of suggest to us that we don't want Q to depend on the position itself. It should only depend on the velocity and perhaps higher order. Well, it will have to depend on higher order time derivatives. So this is our motivation for writing down L and H of this form. But that's it. Beyond this, we assume nothing about the specific form of TV or Q. And we go through and we do the same procedure again. And then, because we don't know how many orders we need, we systematically increase the order until we find something that works. And it turns out that now things are very constrained to the point that there are essentially no solutions below third order. So if I consider first order, second order, there's no form of Q I can come up with that satisfies these conditions. I have to go to third order before I find something that satisfies these conditions. And what I find is this expression here, strange looking nonlinear thing that goes up to third order in the time derivative. And there's an arbitrary constant out front, B. If I set B equal to h bar squared, then I get a dynamical law for this trajectory that is equivalent to quantum mechanics, it turns out. So again, nowhere did I use the Schrodinger equation. I tried to derive this, you know, for more general principles. And yet, what I wind up with, although it's a trajectory equation, is mathematically equivalent to the Schrodinger equation. So you can work out what the final equation of motion is. It's the equation at the bottom of this slide here. It involves fourth order time derivatives in x. And other than that, it looks like, you know, Newton's laws. And this form, so what this actually is the solution for a time-independent one-dimensional quantum scattering problem. And it for technical reasons I won't get into, if you replace the time derivatives with spatial derivatives, you get exactly the form that I showed you earlier. So there are reasons why you can replace the time and space derivative for a time-independent solution. And that basic form for the quantum potential or for the quantum force is something that you see almost no matter what you do. When you go to the many-dimensional generalization, this same basic form comes back. When you go to the relativistic generalization, the same basic form comes back as well. So it's something that, although it looks kind of messy and arbitrary, it's really hard to get away from. So the way that this works, we now have an equation for a trajectory. It's a fourth order equation, so we need to specify four initial conditions, x, x dot, x double dot, x triple dot. If you set x double dot and x triple dot to zero, and if your potential is flat, as it is in this example here, so we imagine we have a barrier scattering problem like this, and we imagine we have an incident wave that's a plane wave. There's going to be a reflected wave because of the scattering potential, and then a transmitted wave that's a plane wave. This is what the wave description tells us the quantum solution looks like, but we can solve this using this trajectory formalism. And actually, when we do that, it's more convenient to start on the transmitted side, because for a plane wave, the trajectory is just a classical trajectory. It's just a straight line. And so we can set the higher order derivatives to zero, propagate backwards in time. And this gives us a very, very efficient way to solve the Schrodinger equation for scattering problems. And if you do this kind of thing for a living, which I do, you often have to resort to optical potentials and all kinds of nasty, difficult strategies for getting the right boundary conditions for these scattering solutions. But all of that goes away here. We can get exact answers with just a single trajectory. The other thing you see is, so here's a picture of the trajectory on the left side. You can see on the product side, it's just a straight line. On the reactant side, because of interference, this manifests as a trajectory that oscillates. And you see this kind of pattern if you're familiar with Bohmian mechanics and the trajectories that you get from Bohmian mechanics. It's the exact same thing you see in that context as well. So I said I wouldn't discuss numerics, and I won't, but I do want to talk about some of the symmetry properties of this equation. We've already discussed the energy that comes out of the fact that that there's time translation symmetry. But if we're in an asymptotic region where there's no potential, where the potential is flat, Noether's theorem also tells us that the momentum should be conserved, that there should be a conserved momentum quantity. Now, interesting thing is if you read the classic text on Bohmian mechanics, Peter Holland's book, he laments the fact that there is no conservation of momentum law in Bohmian mechanics. And the reason is very clear based on the equation I showed you at the start of this talk, that the quantum potential is an external potential that has, in general, neither space nor time translation symmetry. So even if the potential itself, even for a free particle, you don't have this property that there's some kind of quantity that's conserved, momentum quantity that's conserved along a trajectory. But in fact, you do. In our approach, which is a more of a self-consistent approach, is everything comes from the trajectories themselves. There's nothing from the outside. It turns out that there is a conserved momentum quantity, and this is it here. So it's the classical momentum plus this extra piece here. And again, it looks kind of complicated and nonlinear and all of that, involving higher order derivatives. But what this essentially does is it takes all those wiggles that you saw earlier in the trajectory, and it flattens them out. This is a plot of the Noether momentum quantity on either side of the barrier. And you see as you go over the barrier, of course, it's going to change. But in both asymptotic regions, it's flat. And the value is different in the two asymptotic regions. That's actually also very important. This tells you how to compute transmission and reflection probabilities. So all one has to do in practice is propagate a trajectory until this quantity flattens out, even though the trajectory itself oscillates. And then you're done. Then you have very accurate transmission and reflection probabilities for this scattering problem. So numerical results, I said I would skip them. I'll skip so this as well. Question? Yeah, please.
So this momentum, is this the momentum you get from, if you have the Lagrangian and you take the
extra derivative? You just applied Noether's procedure and it pops out. Okay. So, but it also has it has fundamental significance, but also has a practical advantage if you're trying to compute scattering quantities. Okay. So yep. Sure.
There is no initial distribution that you
need. Yeah, here there isn't because it's a very limited context of one dimension
scattering.
Time independent. In that context, the Schrödinger equation becomes an ODE, not a PDE. And so you just replace it with an ODE for a single trajectory. But as soon as you go even to one dimension time dependent, then you need the ensemble again. So the true solution is, of course, with the ensemble. This is just a very simple special case to kind of get the flavor across of where it comes from. And also the fact that you can derive all of this not starting from the Schrödinger equation, but starting from somewhere else. Okay. So again, that's a very limited context. For this to be practical, we have to generalize in various ways. And so as I mentioned earlier, even in the case of one physical dimension but time-dependent wave packets, you need an ensemble. So psi of x and t gets replaced with x as a function of c and t. And c, it can be defined however you wish. One natural way to define it, the way we originally defined it, is as the initial value of a given trajectory at some predetermined time. But you can also define it, it's more natural, we think now, to define it as a coordinate in terms of which the probability density becomes uniform. And if it's uniform at some initial time, it remains uniform at all times. But you can consider arbitrary reparameterizations. And so the way that we derive the PD that I showed you earlier is basically we take the Schrödinger equation and we do this sort of unipolar de Broglie-Madelung-Ansatz where we decompose psi into its amplitude and its phase. So this is the sort of the heart of Bohmian mechanics as well. It's very much the same thing. And then we convert all of the derivatives in terms of space and time into derivatives in terms of C and time. So C now becomes our new spatial coordinate. And so, for example, the hydrodynamic derivative, which is the derivative along a trajectory, that just becomes the partial derivative with respect to C because the value of the parameter C doesn't change along a trajectory. And then X prime is also similarly defined. It's just the derivative of X as a function of CT with respect to C at constant T. And then we just rewrite the Schrödinger equation in terms of these derivatives applied to these two components, R and S. And when you get that, you get two equations out. One is the continuity equation, which tells you that probability is conserved along individual trajectories. So that's important. That's also known from Bohmian mechanics. And then the second equation is the dynamical equation. I'll just jump ahead here. Which is the one I showed you earlier, this one here. Now, this is specifically in the case, as I mentioned earlier, of a C coordinate that for which the probability density is uniform. And in that case, you have this relationship between density and the gradient of x with respect to C. So that does lead to a simplification. But as I said, there's a more general form you can derive as well. So OK, so this is how we get then to the true equation, the one-dimensional time-dependent equation. It's the same one I showed you earlier. But now we also have in this more general context several conservation laws, which again we get by applying Noether's theorem to the Lagrangian. And so here are three of them. And so one of them is energy conservation, which we already know about. Of course, now, because we have an ensemble of trajectories, we're really talking about a Lagrangian density, not a Lagrangian per se. And so all these conservation laws take the form of continuity equations. Right? The gradient of some flux cancels out the change in time, the time derivative of a density. So there's an energy density and an energy flux, and same with momentum. But we also have an extra symmetry that's associated with the coordinate C. Remember, now we have two different space coordinates. We have x and c, and they both give rise to different conservation laws. So this is the C conservation law here, excuse me. And it took us a long time to sort of figure out what this means physically. But essentially what it means is that your velocity field has to be single-valued. And so you can't develop caustics as you would, for example, in a classical statistical ensemble of trajectories. Right? The trajectories would cross, and if they carry probability, then you get infinite probability density, and you get multi-valued velocity fields and so forth. And that never happens in quantum mechanics. And in the wave-based picture, of course, we know that it never happens because the velocity is the gradient of the phase, and the phase is only single-valued. At any point in space and time. So, but anyway, this is a sort of the mathematical expression of that property. And it comes out as this sort of third conservation law. OK, and we can do some calculations along those lines as well. And before moving on, I should mention that we can generalize this for many dimensional case also. So here what I've done is, this gets a little bit messy, but I've tried to kind of show you the connection between the 1D forms and the many dimensional forms. Everything basically is related to the Jacobian matrix that describes a coordinate transformation from C to X. Right? And that, of course, is a time-dependent coordinate transformation, but it is invertible, again, because of the fact that these trajectories don't cross. And so you have an invertible transform between C and X, and that allows you to define a Jacobian matrix and the inverse matrix K. And based on those matrix elements and their derivatives, you can generalize the definition of Q and also of the quantum force, and finally the evolution equation, which is given at the bottom of the screen. So you can also, go ahead, yeah.
I'm going to ask the question right before you moved on, so maybe you should finish what you're saying.
Oh, okay, all I was going to say was that Jacobian tensors are a hop, skip, and a jump away from metric tensors, and you can also rewrite all of this in terms of metric tensors and their derivatives. And of course, that's what we do for the relativistic generalization. And it winds up, you know, becoming a pretty straightforward thing, actually, to do that.
So my question is, actually, maybe a few slides back would be a better place to start. But these derivatives with respect to C that are in the fundamental equation.
Mm-hmm.
So if the in this the conventional approach, the Bohmian approach, my initial wave function had nodes, right? Then at those nodes where the amplitude of the wave function goes to zero, the phase is not defined, and therefore the velocity field is not defined. Right? So this is just part of the standard approach that we don't have trajectories at the nodal points in the standard approach. So what I'm wondering is what happens to your notion of derivative with respect. So suppose you take C to be the initial position, which would be one of the conventions. So if it so happens that initial wave function has nodes, then at the points where the wave function goes to zero, it seems like that derivative would not be well defined, right? Because you don't have a trajectory for the.
You do still have issues at nodes. So in when people try to apply, for example, Bohmian mechanics to real problems, there is this thing called the node problem. That's essentially the issue that you're describing, you can't really evaluate or take the derivative right at the node. And in this approach, you can improve upon the node problem from a numerical standpoint somewhat, but it's still an issue. It doesn't go away completely.
So I'm wondering, leaving aside numerical issues, but just conceptually, if I take the Bohmian approach, the quantum potential goes to zero at the nodal points, doesn't contribute. But in your equation where you have these derivatives with respect to C, how do I interpret those at nodal points? Do I say they're zero, or they're ill-defined, or like what's the kind of formal solution?
So the quantum potential can diverge. So in regular Bohmian mechanics, okay, the quantum potential can diverge at a node. It can actually go to a finite value. If the Laplacian of R goes to zero at the same in the same manner that R itself does, for example, you can have a finite value. That's what happens for bound states. For example, bound states of the harmonic oscillator, excited harmonic oscillator states, quantum potential is well defined everywhere. Smooth, finite, it's not infinite, it's not zero, and it's not discontinuous. So the same is true here. But numerically, there are issues that arise. So now there also are other cases where it can diverge, where mathematically Q can diverge at a node. It really depends on the node. It depends on the context. So, but it's numerically it's exactly the same thing here. So mathematically, where Bohm's Q diverges, R Q diverges, and where it's finite, R's is finite. Okay. So I think in the interest of time, I'll probably skip. This discussion of, you know, what it means, for example, what does it mean for the wave function to collapse if there's no wave? Interesting question. I do want to jump ahead a little bit before I get to the relativistic generalization, which I definitely also want to discuss, and talk about possible experimental validations. And in the course of this, I'll also bring up again Howard Wiseman's approach, which is the discrete version of what I've just described. So is it possible that this theory is something we could ever test experimentally? Well, there are sort of three different ways in which we might be able to do that. So first of all, I stopped when I was working out my original analysis, deriving the 1D time-independent case, and working out the form of the quantum potential in terms of higher order time derivatives. I stopped at third order because that was the first place I had to stop. But that doesn't mean that there aren't higher order terms. that one could also add and still satisfy the same criteria that I laid out. In fact, it is possible to do that. You can show that at any odd order above 3, there's at least one mathematical solution, and a meromorphic solution, which is also important in terms of getting trajectories that are well-behaved. So in principle, there could be higher order terms that contribute. And if so, then one might, in principle, notice this in an experiment. The other thing, too, is the relativistic generalization of this. What's the non-relativistic version, as I've already explained, is equivalent to non-relativistic Schrödinger quantum mechanics. But interestingly enough, when you generalize this for relativity, you find that you don't get the Klein-Gordon equation out. You get something else. So you do actually have something, a relativistic equation, that is something that, in principle, you could test. And then the third way that you might test this, if Howard Wiseman and his coworkers are indeed correct, if, in fact, the trajectories are discrete rather than continuous, then there's some kind of spatial lattice spacing that would be observable in experiment. In other words, if you go down below a certain scale, you should see classical behavior. You shouldn't see quantum behavior anymore. And it could be argued that for all the experiments that we have done to date, we haven't come anywhere close to this scale, which presumably is Planck length-ish or something like that. But this, in principle, is a third way that one might see validation of this particular approach over the usual wave-based quantum mechanics. So, and while I'm at it, I should probably talk a bit more about the differences between our approach and Howard's. As I mentioned, they use discrete ensembles. And so one thing that you don't get in that approach is any kind of action extremization principle, at least not that I'm aware of, because that comes from having some kind of a smooth field to work with. On the other hand, there are certain advantages to that approach. One is that probability in R is we're not explaining where the probability comes from. You have to have some kind of probability measure that's there to begin with. But in Howard's approach, you simply count trajectories. All of the trajectories are weighted equally. And so you simply count trajectories to extract from that a probability. So it's a little bit nicer and cleaner that way. In terms of spin, that's something that we're both working on. Again, for us, spin is a little bit hard because it's discrete, and this is all Lagrangian trajectory based. So we all of the equations I've derived assume that we have some kind of underlying smooth space, and it's not entirely clear how we generalize that in a natural way for spin. So we're working on that. Okay, let me talk a bit about the relativistic generalization. I should leave, 5 minutes for questions at the end? Something like that? Okay, so.
Questions. I mean, with Bohmian mechanics, people have worked out ways of dealing with spin. I think one of them is to use a sort of spinner-valued or vector-valued wave function. So what if you just plug that into your machinery?
Yeah, so they have a bit of an advantage over us, because they have a wave function.
Yes.
We don't have a wave function.
No, but you, in your second derivation, you started with a wave function. And you did this Madelung type of decomposition.
Yeah, so what you could do is you could tack spin on.
Yeah.
On top of the trajectories. But it's a bit ad hoc. So you would, for example, you would probably, in terms of how spin evolves over time, you would just get that from regular quantum mechanics as opposed to from some underlying action principle. So yes, you're absolutely right. We could start with the Schrödinger equation, get something out that would work, but my goal is really to derive from something that's more underlying, as much as we can.
But go back to the non-relativistic. Did you derive in higher dimension? Did you derive that also from something?
Right, yeah, you can do it either way. So all of these equations you can derive more or less in the same way as I showed you for the 1D time independent, correct? Yeah, so.
Just to follow up on Rafael's question.
Yeah.
I'm not sure you caught this or not, but there is a way of doing spin and bombing mechanics.
There is, yeah.
Well, there's multiple ways. So there's one such way where you don't introduce any degree of freedom beyond the particle's position. So it's not as if you have trajectories over a configuration space of particle position and, you know, something else. It's just still particle position, right? So that's the only ontology. It's just that the particular form of the guidance equation changes. So all the effects of spin are in the dynamics and not in the choice of configuration space. So that approach to spin seems well suited to what you're doing. Because you could just say, ah, the Lagrangian and the form of the quantum potential is different when we incorporate spin. Configuration space is exactly the same. Let's see if we can do these same tricks for this new revised quantum potential.
Okay. So the two approaches I know are both in Holland's book. So he discusses two different approaches to spin in that book. If what you're describing is different from those, then we should talk.
It's Bell's approach. So if you look at John Bell's book, Speakable and Unspeakable, there's a chapter in there.
Okay.
Right. So I'm not sure.
It must be in that book.
I would think so. But anyway, I'm always eager to learn, you know, other ways of doing things. And if this is helpful, that would be great.
Yeah,
that would
be great. The interesting thing is what Rob said.
Yeah. You can certainly write down equations that will work. We may be saying the same thing. I think I agree that you can write down equations that work. The question is, where do they come from? Do they come from an action principle? You know, do they come from starting with the Schrödinger equation and then transforming? But in any event, I'll certainly get the reference from you later and look into it. So, okay. Relativistic generalization. So what I'm interested in doing, and here's sort of the chemist coming out again. In chemistry, we do a lot of times what we call electronic structure calculations. We have some molecule or some small material or whatever, and we're interested in computing the electronic structure. So computing the states of the electrons in their ground state for different geometries, say, of the molecule or the material. And that, in and of itself, is a difficult calculation, but we have black box codes, we have density functional theory methods, and so forth, that do a pretty good job of computing these things. But one of the frontiers nowadays is to include relativistic effects in a non-ad hoc kind of a way. And of course, we know, according to physics, that as soon as you throw relativity in with quantum mechanics, then you have to go to field theory to get something that really works. If, for example, you have a particle without spin and you try to apply the Klein-Gordon equation to it, again, that's fine in a second quantization context. But if you try to interpret the Klein-Gordon equation as a single particle relativistic quantum equation, then there's all kinds of problems that arise. You get negative probability densities. Depending on how you look at things, you can have faster than light or backwards in time motion. And of course, we also have this issue of positive and negative energy states that emerge in the solutions of the Klein-Gordon equation. So actually, I think I'm going to skip all of this stuff in the interest of time. I will just say that that a lot of those problems, not all of them, but a lot of them seem to go away in the relativistic quantum trajectory picture. So one of the things that you, so for example, the negative energy states go away. If you can, I didn't show you exactly how to do it, but you can connect trajectory ensembles to quantum waves. There's a way to do that. And when you do that in the relativistic context, you find that the positive and negative energy solutions, they both map to the same trajectory solutions. So you really don't have negative energy solutions in the trajectory picture. You only have positive energy solutions. The other thing, too, is that you don't have any faster than light motion. All the trajectories are moving slower than the speed of light. And all the probabilities are positive. So those kinds of things are all resolved and don't cause any problems. In addition to that, you also have, you can restore the notion of global simultaneity for accelerating particles that you have in special relativity, but we seem to lose in whenever we have accelerating particles. So maybe I will show you this part. So if we have an inertially moving particle or observer that traces out a single whirl line, the red line there, that's enough to define an entire inertial frame in special relativity. So we can talk about the dashed lines there are simultaneity manifolds. They're points that all occur at the same time from the point of view of the moving observer, inertially moving observer. But if that observer is accelerating, we lose that. We can only talk about local simultaneity. So that's unfortunate. But when we have an ensemble of quantum relativistic trajectories, we can restore that notion of global simultaneity. And you know, you have to work out the math and show that it all works. And actually, in 1 plus 1 space-time, it's pretty trivial. But you have to show that it also works in 3 plus 1 space-time, because these things are curved and so forth.
That's right. But it doesn't work in higher dimensions.
It does work in higher dimensions.
Unless you have some special condition.
You do have a special condition, but the special condition is one of your conservation laws. So the C conservation law actually allows you to define these things.
It's kind of interesting. I'm not surprised, actually. I mean, it's like the Ertl's theorem or something. It's a theorem about fluid, non-rotational, or conservation of vorticity in fluid.
You're right. It's close. So I need to talk to you as well and learn about it. I don't know this theorem, but you're right. This ties in with this idea of vorticity as well. So that's definitely something I need to learn more about. But yeah, so this comes out. So this C conservation law I mentioned earlier, which didn't seem to have a real special significance in the non-relativistic case, is absolutely essential for being able to define these simultaneity manifolds globally in the relativistic context. And then there are some other kind of fun things you can do. There's a kind of a twin paradox that emerges here. When you're in the... I'm essentially out of time, but... So you have a quantum potential that affects the passage of time much the same way that the gravitational potential does. In the weak field limit, you can see it looks very similar. The difference, though, is that the quantum potential can be either positive or negative. And so when you're in the classically allowed region, you have time dilation, as you do in regular relativity theory. But when you're in a tunneling regime, which is something that only happens in quantum mechanics, then the sign flips and you have time compression instead of time dilation. That happens in that context. And with that, I think I will end. I often get asked these questions, so to save time, I put up this Have You Tried It list. But first, let me thank everybody, including my Canadian host. It's been a great visit. I've been thrilled to be here. Had a great week. So I'll go back to this list in case this influences some of your questions.
You didn't show us what the relativistic formulation was.
Yeah, I know. I have the equation here. Here it is. Here's the evolution equation. So first of all, but to really understand this, okay, let me show you something else first. So there is no way to make proper time consistent with this idea of the simultaneity manifolds I showed you earlier. So those simultaneity manifolds are the contours of an ensemble time. Okay, so you can define this, you can make it as proper time-like as possible, and that's
crucial. The trajectories don't cross.
It is crucial. Exactly right. That's right. It's absolutely crucial. Otherwise, you can't define this at all. So the capital tau thing there is what we call ensemble proper time, and it is not the same as proper time for any given trajectory. But the relationship is given to you by the quantum potential. So if the quantum potential is zero, then you have what we call a quantum inertial frame. You have a bunch of trajectories all moving in parallel. It's literally an inertial frame. But if they're accelerating, then there are quantum forces. And again, what's interesting here is that Q appears not as a gradient, but the absolute value of Q matters. That's why if it's positive versus negative. So in that sense, it's like the gravitational potential as well. But it's important to understand the relationship between little tau, which is proper time, and capital tau, which is ensemble proper time, and that they're related through this the exponent of Q over mc squared. Okay, so now we can go to the evolution equation. There it is.
The evolution equation, there's no proper time, is that right?
That's right. This is in terms of the ensemble time. And so first of all, you notice that space and time are treated on an equal footing. Right? We have an x alpha there, so that includes t, as well as the spatial coordinates. However, this equation is second order in capital tau, the intrinsic or ensemble proper time coordinate, and it's also fourth order in c, which becomes our, the trajectory labeling coordinate we still have, same one we had in the non-relativistic context. And so we have different orders, but that's perfectly fine because we're not talking about x and t, we're talking about c and capital tau.
What's gamma?
Sorry?
What's gamma in the bottom? Q is defined in the bottom.
Oh, down here. Yes, right. Okay, so I'll show you what gamma is. It's the spatial part of the metric tensor. So the metric tensor, okay, let me go back to this plot here. What we're essentially doing is a coordinate transformation from xt to c tau, where the contours of c tau are the contours you see there. And they're skew orthogonal everywhere. Right, you can see that where this, wherever a dashed line and a solid line cross, they're skew orthogonal. So what that does is it constrains the form of the metric tensor to be block diagonal.
Right.
Okay? And so the spatial part of the metric tensor is gamma. But we've also done, we've done, for example, the what does the relativistic free particle Gaussian wave packet look like? That's a problem we've solved. Not analytically, unfortunately, but numerically. And you can do a Lorentz boost to it and see that all the probability conservation laws still hold and all of that. If people are interested in that, I've got some slides. But anyway, back to the evolution equation, which is this one here. So F is essentially the quantum force. It's the gradient and this is for a free particle. So the only force is the quantum force. So it's a gradient of the quantum potential. This factor is essentially there to convert little t to big tau. And then this term is basically a correction, the higher order derivative correction, like a Christoffel symbol or something like that, basically.
And there's a probability conservation.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, there's, are you interested in that? Let me show you. Do you want to see the equations or do you want to see an example of that? I can show you really well.
Well, the chair should say how far
we can work on the
temple. Okay.
So let's see equations.
Okay. All right. See, first of all, if I had any here that I don't think I had any of the probability discussion in these slides. Thinking I wouldn't have time for them. But I do later on. Okay. So it becomes an assumption of this approach that probability is conserved along trajectories. But in the relativistic context, you have to be a little bit careful about what you mean by probability. Whether you're talking about an object that, so for example, if we have a probability distribution in space, is this something that is that should be integrated only over space or over space and time? So there's several different kinds of probability. But I think probably the most convenient way to express the probability conservation law, let's see if I can find it here. This is all dynamical stuff. Nope, this is conservation laws. What's that?
It's all for free particle or?
It's all for free. I mean, you can add an external potential easily enough, electromagnetic potential. We haven't done that in these equations, but it's just another term that adds, basically. You can already get accelerating particles even without external fields because of the quantum forces. So you can get, you know, a full range of dynamical behaviors without an external field. Sorry, I'm trying to find the probability stuff. Ah, here we go. Okay. Yeah, so we do have a... we have a four-vector quantity for probability and flux, which is the easiest one to work with. And that satisfies the continuity equation. So this tells you that... so this is the thing that would replace the J in Klein-Gordon. And this is always satisfied. Also, the flux is essentially the probability density times the velocity, and the velocities are always less than the speed of light, so you don't have any problems with going backwards in time or anything like that.
If you take, this is at some level equivalent to the Klein-Gordon equation with positive frequency, positive energy condition or not?
No, it's
so
not.
It's not. So then if you took a solution.
So the connection with Klein-Gordon is very interesting.
Then you wouldn't, there's no particular relation between this probability current and anything that you.
In Klein-Gordon, that's correct.
Right?
That's correct. But nevertheless.
Hilbert space somehow different?
There's no Hilbert space here. There's
secretly, you said you could go back
that's right.
to a wave function.
And I've done that. And we learned something very interesting about how this compares to Klein-Gordon. And I'll show you what that is.
Okay.
So essentially, I have to go back. Well, I apologize for this.
This is 3 or 4 lectures. Though.
Yeah, I know. that's why I said I would just, you know, tailor the talk. But okay, all right. So if you have what I call a quantum inertial particle, this is a family of trajectories that are all moving in parallel. And they literally create an inertial frame. Quantum potential is zero in this case. This is a solution to our trajectory equations that we can directly compare to the Klein-Gordon solutions. Okay? And when we do that, what we find is that there's a positive energy and a negative energy Klein-Gordon solution, both of which map to just this one trajectory solution. So
but
this
you
is.
You limit yourself to positive energy.
Right.
This
yeah.
map uniquely to
right.
What a plane wave or what?
Yeah, plane wave. Yeah.
So what if it's a wave packet and not?
Well, if it's a wave packet, then it's a different equation. And what's the difference between our equation and that's what I'm going to show you next.
Okay.
If you analyze, so you were talking about taking our equation and going to the wave picture. But I'm actually going to do the opposite. I'm going to take Klein-Gordon and turn it into the trajectory picture and analyze it there. If you analyze the Klein-Gordon equation in the context of our equation here, there's really only one difference between the two. The difference is the following. The way that we compute force for our a quantum force for our particles is by taking gradients only along the simultaneity manifolds. Not in all four directions in space-time. What Klein-Gordon essentially does is evaluate force by taking the derivative of the quantum potential in all four directions, including the time direction. And so we argue that that causes a kind of a causality paradox. You don't want to be computing forces by taking the gradient in the time direction, because the force is the thing that influences your dynamics moving forward in time. So all that we do, literally all we do, is throw out the tau component of the force that you get from Klein-Gordon, and then all these problems go away. So, yeah.
Maybe something strange about this, but maybe.
There's a lot that's strange about it. I don't fully understand it. But. Yeah.
So at various points in your talk, you described the configuration label as being kind of like a proxy for space, physical space.
Right. It replaces, so spatial derivatives get replaced with C derivatives, yes.
Right. Was that identification with physical space important for any of your conclusions, or is it just kind of a very loose analogy?
Well, so in the relativistic context, if you follow, so these simultaneity manifolds are all space-like, right? So these are what happens if you vary the C parameters, keeping lambda fixed. So in that sense, it is a kind of a generalization of space. In the non-relativistic context, it's just you can just think of it as a different set of coordinates for describing space. So you're still describing space, but the coordinates you're using are time dependent.
I think that identification with physical space is an artifact of looking at a single particle. As soon as you consider more than one particle, then your trajectories are through configuration space.
That's right.
The number of different directions is going to go like the dimension of configuration space.
Right.
So it's, you know, that configuration label is going to be more like a configuration space analog. Not
absolutely correct. And so in the relativistic context, we don't know how to do multiple particles. That's hard. But in the non-relativistic context, which we know very well, you're absolutely correct. It's all about the configuration space. It's not about 3D physical space at all.
So follow up on that. In terms of like computational ease, I mean the problem, you know, if I'm looking at many body systems, you know, that to even describe a wave function, I need an exponential number of parameters. And it seems to me in this approach that doesn't alleviate that problem, at least, because you would again have sort of an exponential number of dimensions in your configuration space. Or sorry, you have a number of dimensions in your configuration space that's linear in the number of systems, but it still feels like, you know, if I want to specify the full freedom of the phase profile, you know, that's an exponential freedom. And so you ought to have sort of an exponential freedom in your space of trajectories as well.
So the way that plays out is it depends on your system. So a lot of times you're right, in the general case, if I have just a completely arbitrary Hamiltonian, completely arbitrary potential, then yeah, this doesn't fix the exponential scaling problem, we call it, or the curse of dimensionality. But what very often happens in chemistry is you have one overall path that you follow called the reaction coordinate or the reaction path that takes you from reactants to products. You have all of the perpendicular degrees of freedom that contribute dynamically. You can't ignore them, but you don't explore very far in that direction. So essentially you have a snake, a 1D tube. But it's still a hard problem. It's to get accurate results out. So in that kind of chemistry context, this is very useful because of the probability conservation. So you have, think of this family of trajectories as a set of grid points that automatically moves where the probability is highest. So at this point in time, the wave function's over here. I've got points over here. I'm not wasting space. I don't have grid points over here in this region of space where they're not needed, only where they're needed. Later on, the wave packet moves over here. What's that? Sorry?
It's configuration space.
Oh, configuration space is the space of all of the positions of all the particles.
Right, but you're gridding in configuration space in many particle phase.
So in this case, and I will use the board for this.
No, I didn't mean to divert you.
Okay.
I was just...
So if you have a problem that's of this kind, then you don't have an exponential growth in the number of grid points. It's not my contribution. That goes way back to the first chemists who were working. This is exactly why the chemists got interested, exactly why.
Maybe we can end the talk here and continue the discussions after that.
Okay.
There was a question. Any questions? Okay.
Yeah. Practical basic question.
Okay.
So when you are doing numerical simulations for the Bohmian trajectories, you have to evolve the wave function and then also the trajectories.
We don't. That's
so,
yeah, go ahead. Sorry.
Is there a numerical advantage if you do it in this case?
There are a number of advantages, numerical advantages. So actually this is what I was about to put on the board anyway. If you do the usual approach, the way chemists do it, right? What they do is they propagate the family of quantum trajectories, but they have to propagate. So this is x here. This is t. They have to propagate the wave function along each trajectory and then compute derivatives on an unstructured grid. This may start out regular, but it winds up going wherever they go. But remember, we're working in C space as our independent variable. So our grids, as a function of time, no matter what the dynamics are doing, always look like this. So we have regular, rectilinear grids. And so this is a huge simplification in terms of being able to compute derivatives more easily and more accurately.
Well, I was bothering me about it, but I can do it after we, in the informal part or in the formal parts.
Oh, we can end here and then we can talk.
Okay. Thank you.